The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. Today is April 28, 2025, and we do have a quorum present. We have two items on the agenda for today. One is Senate File 2068, which is my bill dealing with DWIs. Vice Chair Mover Benton will chair during that portion of it. And then also, we have an informational hearing on proposed language amendment relating to Section 8 housing. This was heard in the Finance Committee last week, but the issue was raised whether or not there was sufficient opportunity to vet it. And since this proposal would ordinarily have come within this Judiciary Committee's jurisdiction, and we already had this hearing scheduled, we decided to go ahead and have the additional time to review that proposal as well. So at this time, I'm going to hand the gavel over, and we'll take up Senate File 2068.
All right, Senator Lotz, when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Most of you are aware of, may recall, the tragedy in St. Louis Park where a repeat DWI offender got drunk again and drove through the Park Tavern outdoor seating area, killing two members of our community and injuring nine others. As it turned out, that individual was driving on a valid license but had five prior DWIs, which meant that he had completed the required six-year rehabilitation and abstinence proof, got his driving privileges reinstated without an interlock requirement, and was driving validly, but for the fact, obviously, that he had consumed so much alcohol beforehand that he was impaired, and in fact he was over a 0.30 alcohol concentration. So the incident led my colleague from the other body and me to take another look at the DWI statutes and see if there were something more that ought to be done with regard to these provisions to capture those who have a longer history of DWI offenses. As we did that, we took a lot of input from the community, from the interested parties, from the stakeholders, including the DWI task force, and prosecutors groups, defense lawyers groups, others who involved DVS in the process of administering and enforcing DWI law. And the bill that you have before you is the result of that. We did hear this bill in committee before, and members, I think you should have the second engrossment in front of you for review. I will review the content of that bill, and then I have an amendment that has would incorporate some additional changes, not all of them directly related to the incident itself, but whenever we do a review of statutes and areas of law, people involved come forward with other ideas on how to improve that area of the law, and so we've incorporated some of those as well, and I hope that it meets with your approval. The underlying DWI bill proposes two main things substantively. One is to extend the duration of the interlock requirement for a person who commits an offense that invokes that requirement in order to get driving privileges reinstated. Under current law, for example, and this would only apply, by the way, to repeat offenders. So we'll make no changes with regard to interlock requirements or extensions for people who have a first-time offense. But for repeat offenders, meaning if you have one prior within 10 years, the interlock duration is required to be 1 year. If you were under a 0.16. This proposal would extend that now to 2 years. And then it also And it ramps up from there. So if you get a second in a repeat period, instead of 3 years, it becomes 6 years. If you get a third, if you get your third in the look back period, it's 6 years. If you get a fourth in the look back period, it's 10 years. Mandatory interlock to have valid driving privileges. The other thing that we do significantly is we extend the look back period from 10 years to 20 years. So this would capture more people who have repeat offenses and then have a longer duration between offenses, but then do it again. In the case of our individual in St. Louis Park, he had older priors, and had all of those older priors been captured in the interlock duration, he would have still been on interlock at the time of the incident. And apparently he was compliant while he was on interlock in the past. We do a look back period now, extended from 10 years to 20 years. And in some cases, lifetimes. There are other pieces that this bill does. It adds the ignition interlock requirement and availability for those who commit criminal vehicular homicide. In other words, those who get drunk and kill someone else, right now they are not eligible at all for valid driving privileges under the interlock. I would argue that the people who most need to be on interlock, which is a proven safety device, meaning it has a substantial reduction in recidivism in driving while drunk. The people who most need that are the ones who have committed the greatest harm while driving drunk. So we currently allow it for criminal vehicular operation. We have not allowed it for criminal vehicular homicide. So this bill adds that provision to the statute, and then it eliminates the look-back period there. So if a person has a prior and then they commit a criminal vehicular homicide, their interlock period would be 15 years. If they've got two priors and they do it, they'll have a lifetime on interlock. So a substantial extension of the length of time they'd be on interlock. The bill also increases the penalty for violating the interlock requirement. If you are subject to the interlock and you are driving a vehicle in some way that you interfere with the interlock components of it, it becomes a gross misdemeanor from a misdemeanor offense. It requires all repeat offenders to complete treatment or rehabilitation as a condition for full unrestricted driving privileges. Current law applies that condition to a more limited number of repeat offenders. It extends the temporary driver's license revocation when you are subject to a DWI arrest and you're served with the notice of revocation and plate impoundment from 7 days to 14 days. This will bring into line a more realistic timeline for people to actually go ahead and apply for and qualify for and get an interlock device installed. It also, as a corollary, because the plate impoundment orders apply to all plates for vehicles, for all vehicles that a driver is a registered owner on, they are required to turn in those plates as well. This extends that turn-in date from 7 days to 14 days also. Something that's been on the in the pipeline for a long time to improve the administration of the plate impoundment statute, supported I know specifically by law enforcement, the DWI task force, I think it was proposed by the task force over the years, was rather than requiring the plate actually be physically seized and destroyed by the police department, this would allow the police department to put a sticker on the plate that would demonstrate the plate can't be used, it's not valid for driving, and then it would create a misdemeanor crime to remove or damage that sticker. This bill also addresses forfeiture. Currently, there is an interlock exception to the forfeiture law whereby a person can avoid forfeiture on the vehicle involved in the offense If they enter the Interlock program and drive that particular vehicle with the Interlock device in it. The problem arises when that vehicle is perhaps damaged beyond repair, is inoperable, and then the person doesn't have the ability to get into, to avoid a forfeiture and the costs that could be involved, even if they wanted to get the vehicle back and part it out. So this came as a proposal from stakeholders in the field to suggest that the Interlock would apply, or this exception would apply to any vehicle, meaning it would allow a person to drive any vehicle of their choice as long as it's installed, has the Interlock device installed, and thereby could avoid the forfeiture of the vehicle that was a part of the offense. Another idea that has come up along the way here that's incorporated in this bill is to allow for judicial review in cases where driver and vehicle services has extended the duration of Interlock due to a violation of the Interlock program. Sometimes these violations come up when there's an allegation a person has blown a .02 on the device, which is the threshold for disabling the start of the vehicle, the ignition of the vehicle. And sometimes those are related to consumption of alcohol, but sometimes, especially in cold weather, they are problems with the Interlock device itself. Sometimes they are because of mouthwash, for example, that someone has used that morning before they got into the vehicle, and within 5 or 10 minutes, that is dissipated. So then it's not measuring alcohol in their body, it's measuring breath alcohol, which dissipates quickly. Sometimes they want to have the ability to challenge DMV's determination that there was a violation. Under current law, there was a recent court decision that concluded the statute did not allow for that judicial review to take place. It had been the practice of the courts and of the Attorney General's office and driver and vehicle services to recognize the court's jurisdiction, but the appeal took place, determined the court did not have that jurisdiction, so this provision would fix that statute. The bill also reduces barriers to entry into the ignition interlock program. Current law, unless you qualify for under the indigency standards, is you have to pay all of the $680 license reinstatement fee up front before you can get your driving privileges reinstated. That's a pretty heavy lift for a lot of people, especially people who are incurring the cost of installing the interlock device into their vehicle and taking on the monthly expenses associated with the monitoring of that device. So this bill changes statute to say that they don't have to pay it all up front as long as they pay it sometime before they get their driving privileges finally reinstated without the interlock requirement after they've completed the period of time or any time along the way. So this will also make it easier for people to decide to enter the interlock program rather than take their chances and simply drive a different vehicle without the interlock. So that's the bill that you have before you. It's what we have heard and was laid on the table for later consideration earlier this session, and I'll ask for your support for that. I do have an A14 amendment that I would also like the committee to consider adding to the bill, which takes some additional pieces into consideration as well. I'd like to offer the A14.
Thank you, Senator Lotz. So you've moved the A14 amendment. Do you want to just explain that a little bit, and then we'll see if there's any discussion on it?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A14 amendment clarifies state statute that out-of-state prior DWIs count for purposes of the look-back period and enhancing the interlock requirements here. It also makes it a gross misdemeanor crime to drive after revocation any vehicle where the person was subject to interlock requirement in order to have valid driving privileges. So it's not just a matter of violating the program while you're driving a vehicle with interlock, But if you choose to drive some other vehicle, what would normally now be a misdemeanor, driving after revocation, would become a gross misdemeanor. The purpose of this, as many of these provisions, is to channel those people who should be on Interlock, who are required by law to be on Interlock, into the Interlock program. The fact is, many people simply choose to take their chances because of the inconvenience or the expense relating getting into the Interlock program, and they just drive vehicles without valid licenses. And so this ups the ante, if you will, the penalties for trying to get around the Interlock program there. With regard to the start date for appealing a decision by the Driver and Vehicle Services about participation in the Interlock program, there was some lack of clarity in the statute about when that appeal time would begin to run. So there's a provision in this amendment that would define that as from the date of the notice of extension. That makes it comparable to other time periods starting to run when they get served with the notice of revocation of their driving privileges or notice of impoundment of their motor vehicle plates. So this clarifies when that basically statute limitations or limitations period begins to run. There are some other technical changes that are being made in here as well that council has identified. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Members, are there any questions? Okay. So we'll take up the A14 amendment first then. Senator Lotz moves the A14 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A14 amendment is adopted. And then to the bill as amended. Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Lotz. This looks like a well thought out bill. Pretty comprehensive. The only part that, and this just may be, I was looking through the bill and I was looking through the statutes, I may just not understand how all this works together. So I just wanted to ask you about adding the criminal vehicular homicide to the Interlock program. So this is somebody who's been convicted under 609.2112. Presumably they might have gone to prison, and this kicks in after they get out of prison. Can you just help me, practically speaking, what happens currently in those situations, and then how your bill would change those people in those situations?
Senator Lotz.
I'm going to ask if council can give us some clarity on that question.
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, members, I think the main change, under current law, you would lose your license, I believe, if you didn't have a prior for 6 years, but you wouldn't be eligible for the ignition into lock. So the bill basically concentrates mostly on repeat offenders. So the loss of license would still be 6 years, but you would be eligible. Well, you'd be eligible to enter the program and get your license that way, but not your, you know, not an unrestricted license.
Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the main change here is you would still lose your license for 6 years, but you'd have a chance to start driving during that six-year period under the Interlock program, and then you add look-back periods and that sort of thing. Is that kind of that in that area of the bill? Would that ability to enter the Interlock program, would that start as soon as they get out of prison, or is there any time requirements there where they just wouldn't be able to drive, or would it happen right away?
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, members, the prison is unrelated, so yeah, I don't, yeah, obviously.
I'll rephrase it.
Senator Kroon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regardless of whether they go to prison, so it's just the 6 years, is there any period where they wouldn't be eligible for Interlock, where they just wouldn't be able to drive, or would they be eligible right away? I guess that's my question.
Mr. Backus.
Madam Chair, members, I'd have to double check, but I believe you'd be eligible right away for just to enter the Ignition Interlock program.
Senator Kroon.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. So that's the only part I'm struggling with a little bit, but I see where you're coming from in that, from your view, the interlock program works well, and you think that for these offenders, public safety would especially benefit by bringing them into the interlock system the same way it would work for the others. So I'm just trying to think about whether or not there should be a period of time where they wouldn't be eligible and they wouldn't be able to drive, and whether that would be more preferable or getting them plugged into the interlock program right away, whether that would be preferable. And I'm just kind of weighing those public policy considerations. But other than that, I think it seems like a pretty good bill. So that's just my only comment. You can comment if you want.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair, I perhaps made an assumption here that I should have stated explicitly. It is well documented through research, studies, and experience across the country that the interlock device is a very effective mechanism for preventing people from driving while drunk. The main hang-up, the main problem has been that people who should be on it aren't on it, either because they are not eligible under statutes to participate in the program, to drive validly and with insurance, which is also a required part of the interlock program, and with treatment protocols in place, either have to be making progress toward or graduate from required treatment programs, or they choose to ignore the interlock and the laws around licensed driving altogether and drive and take their chances that they're not going to get caught and accept whatever penalties there are for driving without those valid driving privileges, which have been lower, have been misdemeanors now, and we're increasing those in this bill to gross misdemeanors. I refer to that as sort of the level of uptake of the program. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they're comparatively low because of the barriers to getting into the program, the cost being the primary one. But there's also, I suppose, a certain amount of embarrassment for people who are driving with interlock, at least for people who get into their vehicles and see that they're having that. So we want to sort of increase the uptake into the program. The fact is, in today's world, and this is even more of the case in greater Minnesota than in the metro area, people need to drive cars to live their daily lives. They need to get to work. They need to get to the grocery store. They need to get their kids to activities, to and from school, and so on. And it's just really, really hard to live your life without driving a vehicle. And so people decide they're going to take that chance. They're not going to quit their job because they still got to pay the rent or the mortgage. They still got to buy food for the family. They're going to take their chances, and they're going to drive. And they know if they get caught, it's a driving after revocation, and it's not that serious an offense. And so the people are going to, they rack up over and over again driving after revocation charges. For the people who are subject to the interlock program, the level of recidivism is very, very low as long as they're participating in the program. And for those, you know, the line between committing a CVO where the result is great bodily harm and a CVH where the result of death is a function of, you know, luck, medical care, that kind of thing. You know, someone dies from their injuries or they don't after there's been an accident. So I didn't see any principled reason to distinguish between those who are currently eligible for CVOs and those who aren't eligible for CVHs. I will add, and this is important to note, Under those provisions, the interlock is only eligible where the underlying offense was alcohol-related. So if the underlying driving while impaired was controlled substance-related, they're not eligible for interlock anyway in the CVO or proposed in the CVH statute, because we don't have an interlock device that can protect against controlled substance use. Someday, hopefully, the technology will catch up to that. I know there are people working on that. There are companies working on that. And believe me, if they can do that, it's going to be great for their business and better for public safety. But we're not there yet. So this would only apply to alcohol-related CVO and CVHs.
Senator Crean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and appreciate that response. I think you've probably persuaded me just in that there probably isn't a principled reason to treat CVOs different from CVHs. I think I get that, and I understand that practically speaking, a lot of people, if they're not eligible for the interlock system, would be driving anyway, taking the chances with the rather harmless penalties that might ensue if they get caught driving. But I guess the only counter to that, and I'm not saying this is the right, that this weighs more heavily than what you're talking about, but just the deterrence factor from doing it in the first place, if you know that it's 6 years that you're not going to be able to drive and the headaches that are going to be associated with that and relying on your family and friends to drive you around. And that, you know, this is all assuming you follow the law and don't illegally drive. Maybe there's more deterrent than, well, I can at least get into the interlock system and it won't disrupt my life too much. I guess that would be the public policy reason for not doing it. But I think you raised some good points on the other side. It's a balancing test, and I think you've been pretty persuasive on that. But that's, I guess, what I was struggling with initially. But overall, I think it's a good bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Lotz.
I appreciate the conversation, Senator Crean. I'll just add that taking away the driver's license from people affects everyone around them and their family as well, whether they're the primary breadwinner or not, certainly if they are. But then relying on family to get them to places punishes the family in the same, you know, quite a lot too. I mean, I've seen it in my own practice, and we've all seen it where, you know, families end up having to drive people to and from work. In greater Minnesota, if they work 30 minutes away or 45 minutes away and they can't, you know, taking an Uber is prohibitively expensive if they're available. There's no bus transportation. And they either quit their jobs or they drive to work, or someone else is cutting back on their own work hours in order to get the person to their job, right? So it really ends up being a burden on whole families. So it seems to me this is a more rational way to approach it.
Yeah. Senator Lass, just to follow up on that, I know there's the slightly increased penalty, but I think the change that allows folks to participate in the interlock program without paying the fee, but only needing to pay the fee before getting the license reinstated, is helpful, because the financial barrier may be why someone isn't able to enter the program, continues to drive without that, and then is a public safety risk. So hopefully removing that barrier, you know, incentivizes more folks to just participate in this program that is good for everyone. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lotz, it's been a while since we visited the cost of enrolling in an interlock device. Could you kind of give a little rundown? You kind of explained it in a way that it was a cost that someone had to bear, and perhaps a financial cost on top of that as a fine. It's costly enough for the internet. Could you tell me what those figures are that a person would have to experience in getting the device installed in their car, and then a monthly fee?
Sure.
Senator Lotz.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, there are, I believe, seven companies that are certified in Minnesota to install and monitor the ignition interlock device. The cost of installation of the device initially is between $300 and $400. It ranges a little bit between companies. And then there's the monthly cost associated with monitoring the device, maintaining it. The drivers have to take the vehicle in once a month for the data to be downloaded and to make the data of the times that they started the vehicle, if there were any positive tests along the way. And that's usually $125 to $175 a month for however long they've got the interlock in the vehicle. By the way, there's another deinstallation fee at the end of the period as well. There is an off-ramp. The companies that install the device are required as a condition of having the certification to provide a lower fee for those who qualify for indigency or lower rates. I'm not sure exactly what the lower rate is, something like 40 or 50% less than the regular rate, at least for the installation. I think it's also lower for the monthly cost. So there's some accommodation there already. But yeah, it is an expensive program to be a part of. Worth it, in my viewpoint. But it is one of those barriers to entry, if you will, that might make people opt out and take their chances.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Is there an additional fee penalty if the person fails to bring the car in for a monthly review of their driving habits, or if they fail the program altogether? Then does a fee kick in or a penalty of some sort?
Senator Watts.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, if I think if they, well, there are, yes, the answer is yes. If they fail any of the requirements of the program, depending on how many times it's happened, driver and vehicle services will extend the duration of the interlock program by 30 days or 60 days or 6 months or even a year. The length of time that they're required to stay on the interlock program before they can get unrestricted driving privileges reinstated. Depending on the what the violation is, there's also criminal penalties and charges associated with those violations. I would assume, but I don't know specifically, that failure to bring the device in for monitoring is included in those categories of failures to comply.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions or comments, so final comments from you, Senator Latz.
Appreciate your support for the bill.
Wonderful.
All right, so I do move that Senate file 2068 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor.
All right, Senator Latz moves that Senate file 2068 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and this bill is on its way to the Senate floor. Thank you, Senator Latz. And we'll have Senator Port come up. And you can begin whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We saw a version of this amendment on the floor with the housing bill. It was ruled not germane at that time. And I worked with Ms. Primo, Mr. Nauman, Senator Latz, and Mr. Olufsen to make some changes and then bring it to the Finance Committee, where Senator Mohammed offered it to the Judiciary Bill, which covers 504B, and it was adopted there. We wanted to make sure we had this conversation in this committee as well. It's a very simple amendment that should the federal government withhold contracted payments of Section 8 housing choice vouchers, it would trigger a 3-month eviction moratorium for those folks who hold Section 8 vouchers. It would also, and this is the part that's different than what we saw on the floor, use fiscal year 26 housing funding to pull together $66.5 million, which is approximately 3 months worth of housing choice vouchers in Minnesota cost, to ensure that those landlords are made whole, that can continue while we hopefully would come in for a special session and figure out how to solve this issue long term. There are 32,600 some vouchers, housing choice vouchers in Minnesota. So should those payments cease, whether through executive action or through DOGE or through just a lack of staff, it would be an overnight housing crisis in the state of Minnesota, and this is just a stopgap for that.
So I'll just add my thoughts on it. I appreciate Senator Port coming to discuss this with me and try to work on a solution. I know that there's a lot of uncertainty in Washington right now. We know that a number of funds have been halted temporarily and reinstated. Crime Victim Services overnight had their access to reimbursements for costs already expended shut off. So eventually, I think much of that was started up again. But this is essentially prophylactic, and the need for it, aside from the uncertainty in Washington, is that if there were to be a cutoff of funds, the legislature couldn't possibly reconvene in a special session and pass a remedy quickly enough to prevent people from either being evicted or to prevent landlords from not receiving crucial cash flow in order to pay their mortgages and utilities on their buildings and so on. So the idea here is to keep people whole on a short-term basis while the legislature then has time to get together and decide whether and if so how to fashion a longer-term remedy. And it's not intended as a long-term solution, but I think it's important that this be in place just in case, because the consequences of not being ready will be so substantial for people who are in housing and for the housing providers that make that happen as well.
And Mr. Chair, if I may.
Senator Port.
I will also note that this expires in November 1st of 2025, because that is the point at which we can still be sure that there is enough money in the 2026 appropriations to cover this. It's also about the time, theoretically, that Congress will pass a budget. And if they were to do this through the budget, that's different than withholding funds that people are already expecting, that there are contracts for, that this is, you know, how they are making their rent payments. And so that would be a different conversation that we would need to have post that budget conversation. But this would get us through to the point where folks who currently have vouchers that they are relying on in case those are withheld.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Port, do you know, I guess a basic question would be, can a state impose a requirement like this on a federal program?
Senator Port.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Limmer, Minnesota Housing Finance and other state entities administer the program in Minnesota. We don't actually require the program to do anything. We're just requiring a state-level hold on evictions should certain requirements be met, but it doesn't actually put any restrictions on HUD for the program.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
It seems by my reading that in the lines 1.4 to point 1.14, that we're adding a condition onto a contract that's held between a landlord and the federal government using a landlord using Section 8 for their property. But we're creating a condition or a requirement that a landlord has to wait 3 months for an eviction process to begin. And that's the filing of the eviction notice. So by the time it gets to court, it's going to be considerably past 3 months. Every landlord looks at his property as a kind of little business. They provide the property for a fee per month. And so, and it's a federal program, so perhaps council can help me out. Can a state impose a requirement like this when the contract is really between a landlord and the federal government?
Ms. Primo.
Mr. Chair and members, my understanding is that there are a few different contractual relationships here. There's an agreement between the tenant and the landlord, an agreement between the tenant and the public housing authority, and then the landlord and the public housing authority. And the public housing authority is a state entity that helps to disperse the funds that are received from HUD and oversees the program. The language at lines 1.4 to 1.14 of the amendment are really about the relationship, the contractual relationship between the tenant and the landlord, the agreement outlined there with, in terms of when the landlord is able to evict the tenant for non-payment of rent. And whether the state can impose such a restriction could potentially be a litigated issue.
Okay. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Council. Another question I had was on line 1.17. I haven't seen this before in a bill proposal, where it makes reference this section is effective upon enactment of a 2025 regular session of a bill styled as Senate File 2298. What does that mean, of a bill styled as another bill that we don't have in front of us?
Senator Port.
Thank you. If I can defer to Ms. Primo on that one.
Ms. Primo.
Mr. Chair and members, that language is unusual. It's not necessarily always not common in bills. And this was modeled with advice from the revisor's office. And essentially, this is intended to refer to the housing the appropriations to the Minnesota Housing and Finance Agency in the current housing omnibus. But it's possible that language could end up being in a different bill, for example, a House file, or if it's combined with some other Senate file. And so this is intended to capture that language and the style of that language wherever it may be found when it's eventually passed.
Ms. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I find it kind of impossible to consider the success of this proposal without having a copy of Senate File 2298, the third engrossment, before us, because we just don't know what it is. And the word styled seems to me to be a reference to similarity versus an exact representation of Senate File 2298. I don't even know if Senate File 2298, well, I guess by the third engrossment, it's evidence that it's gone through a couple, one or two committees, but I certainly don't know what it means and what's included in it or the details, and the word styled as is far from being exact in
Mr. Chair.
Senator Port.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Loomer, it's the housing bill that I believe you voted for on the floor that we had just the other day on the floor. It's the housing omnibus bill. And it references that in this bill only because the money that is the second portion of this comes from that housing finance bill. Should this be required, it comes from the 2026 appropriations in that housing finance bill. But it's taken as a percentage of the whole. It's not taken from one particular program. It's taken as a full percentage. So when we spoke with the revisor, they said this was the way to write it, to say, you mean the housing omnibus finance bill. So whatever form that ends up taking as we move through negotiations, perhaps it won't be the same dollar amount that I have in mind, but it will mean the housing finance bill. The budget bill, which is the money portion that this comes out of.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Loomer.
Thank you for defining this bill for me. And I do remember voting for the bill.
I appreciate that.
However, my concern is more about the word styled as. To me, it seems as if it points toward a similarity of the bill, not an exact reference to the bill, and in addition, it still has a long way to go to get through conference committee as well. So if Senate File 1417 would actually become law and the housing bill that you referenced does not, what standing does this reference have? So just a few questions, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions or comments, discussion from members of the committee? Senator Kroon, and then Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This just seems like a pretty odd funding mechanism to take money from a bill we just passed, or potentially take money from a bill we just passed a few days ago. And I suppose, I mean, I haven't been here that long, I suppose this wouldn't be the first time we passed contingent legislation based on a hypothetical. I don't know how often it happens where it's $66.5 million hypothetical, and the hypothetical is linked to something the federal government might do. Maybe that's happened here. I haven't been around long enough. I'd be surprised if it has to, and then particularly to take the if the hypothetical comes to pass, take it from a bill we just passed. It all seems very confusing to me, which I guess I could get my head around if this was something we thought was very likely going to happen. And it's, I don't know if it's still morning. It's too early to get involved in federal politics right now. I just have no energy to do it. I'm just trying to figure out if this is just a political talking point or if you think this is actually going to happen. I mean, I don't really read the news about the day-to-days going on at the federal government, but this seems like overkill to me to pass contingent legislation based on a hypothetical scenario on something the federal government might do in the future. I mean, if we started passing laws like that, there would be no end to it. We could just sit around and start passing contingent legislation on something the federal government might do. But that's my general thought. I don't really have any interest in engaging into what's going on in the federal government right now. So this is what you all are deciding to do, then I guess that's what will be done.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond.
Senator Port.
Thank you. You know, normally I would agree with you, Senator Kroon, but normally changes in government funding come through the appropriations process in Congress. They come through the congressional budget. They don't come through an agency of young men who are slashing and burning portions of federal programs. We have seen over 50% now of HUD staffers laid off. The concern that I am getting from MHFA and other housing finance agencies across the country is not that Congress is going to cut this money, it's that they're not going to be able to access it, because some days the portal is turned on and other days the portal is turned off. And if it's turned off on a day when they are required to send this money out to the folks who have qualified Section 8 vouchers, who rely on this to pay rent, there is no backstop for them. There is no pot of money. There is nothing they can do. And in Minnesota, we have over 32,000 vouchers, which represent over 100,000 Minnesotans who rely on this rent. I hate this bill. I wish this bill did not have to exist. I don't want to send $66 million of a housing budget that is $160 million a year to pay for something that the federal government has a contract to do. But I am not, at this point, confident enough to adjourn for this year and know that those people's vouchers are safe. I hope they are. I hope that this bill ends up meaning nothing. But I don't feel confident enough to say, we should adjourn, we should hope this doesn't happen, we should hope those people are okay, and just, you know, I guess a wing and a prayer. So that's why I wrote this. It's not a talking point. I think this bill sucks. I don't want to spend a third of my budget on this. But I also don't want 100,000 Minnesotans to not be able to pay their rent overnight should that happen. And so that's the reason I'm asking for your support to move this forward. But I appreciate Senator Latz working with me to make sure that we did have funding. I think we'll continue to talk about the funding stream and where it best comes from. But I do think the risk is there, and we owe it to these 100,000 Minnesotans to say, we'll have your back at least for a little bit to figure out what we can do long term.
Senator Wellstrom.
Mr. Chair, question for counsel first regarding the style question. You said it's rarely used or not often unusual to use it. Can you point back to the last time this was used? What bill and topic was it in that this was used in an example or two? Could you give us that direction? Are we talking like last month or last year or last decade?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not sure when this sort of language, this sort of effective date was last used. I can consult with the revisor's office and others in my office and get back to you. The use of the phrase styled as was a recommendation from the revisor's office to capture the author's intent.
So,
Senator Wellstrom.
So, follow up. Prima, have we ever used this language before? That you know,
Primo.
Mr. Chair and members, that I know of, no, but I have not done an exhaustive search at all, and I was not necessarily involved with the drafting of that specific language. So I am reaching out to other staff in our office to see if they could, if they have any examples of when this was last used.
Senator Wellstrom.
Mr. Chair, I'm not familiar with it either, and it doesn't sound like Senator Limmer is, and so thank you for your answer. Senator Port, what was the reason this wasn't included in your housing bill then, if it's that important to you?
Senator Port.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Wellstrom. At the point that we built my housing bill, they had not yet laid off the staff at HUD. And they had not yet threatened to cut Section 8. That happened in about the last 2.5 weeks, and my housing bill was already moved. We did try to add this on the floor, but it was challenged by Republicans as not germane to the housing bill, so we added it to Judiciary, which has 504B.
Senator Wellstrom.
Mr. Chair, one more question. Senator Port, as I recall our Minnesota Constitution, the legislature can't impair a contract. How are you getting around that constitutional requirement with your bill and that you've drafted? Or is this an unconstitutional bill, probably?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Port.
Thank you. This doesn't change anything about the contract. It sets a requirement for the state of Minnesota to be able to refill that amount of money that you are missing, and it puts a pause on evictions. We saw during the pandemic that there was eviction moratoriums challenged many times in court, and that they were upheld.
Ms. Primo.
Mr. Chair and members, I did receive an example that from the revisor's office. It was in 2020. I'm not sure exactly which bill, but it looks like it's a tax provision. And the effective date read, this section is effective for taxable years beginning after December 31st, 2020, only upon enactment in the 2021 regular session of a bill styled as House File Number 1065. And then it goes on a little further with a citation.
All right, so we have precedent. I'm just going to make one other note that the purpose of the funding provision here is in large part to protect the landlords. if someone owns a four-unit building or a six-unit building and four of the units are Section 8, and all of a sudden the rent's not being paid because there's not HUD staff available or the website's turned off, or whatever it is, you've got a landlord that is stuck paying a mortgage with only one third of the revenue coming in for the building and would never be able to do it. This is not as much about the really large landlords who have access to cash reserves or bank loans and stuff like that can get them through a short-term interruption of cash flow, but it's about a lot of the smaller landlords who would really, really be pinched if the federal contract that they were counting on, the reliability, the stability that is supposed to go along with one of the values of providing Section 8 housing for a landlord if that's interrupted, it's not only about them then having to, you know, to protect their own assets, file eviction notices to try to get rent-paying tenants in there. But also it's about just preserving their ability to maintain their cash flow for their business. So we hope that this is never needed because this will be disruptive to everyone, and not least of which the courts that are going to face a flood of eviction notices if we don't pass something like this too. But that said, appreciate the discussion today. This is for informational purposes only. So I think we've had some good questions raised, and there'll be some follow-up in light of those questions. Members of the Senate is under call right now to begin our session for today. So with that, we're going to adjourn today's Judiciary Committee hearing, and we'll head off to session. We are adjourned.